Session number 10699.
Brigadier Rymer Jones, Reel 2. You were telling me about the second time you took the exams and how you were again afflicted with an eye problem, pink eye, you called it.
Yes, well, of course, it was very difficult for me in the first part of the exam because of my eyes, but we managed to get along, and Foss Brown and I passed very well into it. He being a scientific side of the school, naturally did well. I had to take two maths exams, although I hadn't done any maths for a couple of years, and only some 600 people took the exam, which had to wait half of them for 6 months before they went to the shop. The rest of us, Post Brown out of the 600, got in about 14th and was automatically offered sappers. And although I was just below, they did offer me sappers, but sappers wasn't my mind. I had been a classic and modern languages to my joy. And so when I passed out of this very sturdy life, where you work from morning till night, started on a horse in the riding school, and you didn't touch scientific gunnery at all there. You just did a bit of gun drill, and you passed all these, quite a lot of school work still, and you shoved that all in 6 months. And you enjoyed every moment of it.
When did you actually first go there?
In July
1915.
No cadet, I think, that ever passed, or very few, didn't adore the place. I was an instructor there later on, before I transferred to Pace, and it was equally delightful place. Yes, oh yes, because there was tremendous enthusiasm, particularly for the sappers and gunners. And in afterlife, you felt that that had done you so much good in an enthusiasm for your country, for the place itself, and what you'd learnt there, and the marvellous people. I don't know why it was, but I think I've met more delightful people in the sappers and gunners than in any other part of the army. And it was a great joy to me to find that the same enthusiasm was there when I was a company commander and instructor later on.
What kind of daily routine? What would a typical day be like at the shop? How was it organised? Do you remember still?
Do you remember in the wartime?
Yeah, while you were there being trained. What time would the day start, and what would you do?
Yeah, we're talking wartime. Of course, it's a rush job, you know. And you're nearly always on first parade was down at the riding school for riding. That was very popular in itself, of course, because you must remember, in all that first part and in the war, we practically lived on horses when we weren't actually in action with the guns. And we'll come to that a bit later, what happened to the horse in war. But you went on with every sort of thing, classroom work, drill, of course, particularly in the first part. You passed out at drill, and that was always my joy. I was always top in drill, and in the gym. But you were very tired, but you loved every moment of it. I don't know why. Mark, we'd got people there who'd been out in the war as troopers and so on. The senior under-officer and his brother, who became an under-officer as a cadet, had been a year out in France as troopers in the lifeguards. They were both Tunbridge boys, and like so many people from public schools, like from mine, a very gallant and clever fellow at all games, Bedingfield in my house, for example. He didn't wait like us to become regulars and go out. He went out at the age of 17 and was in the first 100,000, you know. And he wrote. They were having a frightful time, but he thought like everybody else did till they got a bit fed up with being cannon fodder. They enjoyed every moment of it. They knew it was hard, and you knew you were going to be killed in that part. And the old boys at the top were far too old, the commanders in the war, people who'd been generals in the Boer War, people like French, Haig, and so on. And it was really a young man's war like the Second World War was. So that was bad. But at any rate, at the shop, he finally passed out, and then you immediately went on a gunnery course, the more scientific part. This was at Shoebury Ness, actually. And then I was posted.
What was the gunnery course like? What did you do on the gunnery course? What were you trained in there?
Well, you did shooting. You learnt all about that side of it, the scientific side, because shells don't always fall in the same place. And you've got the meteorological alterations, temperature of the charge, temperature of the shell, wind, drift, as good as knows what. And well, you did your shooting from an OP, observation post, and then sent your corrections down to the actual gunners. That's the sergeant and his men on the guns. And, of course, they didn't always land in the same hole, as I said before. You had what they called a 50% zone. And this affected with shrapnel. I've explained what shrapnel is. And so that you've got to make, you've got to take care that you weren't firing a barrage for the people advancing, so that some of the shells were coming where your men were advancing. Do you see what I mean? You had a, and this is very bad. Shrapnel nearly lost the blooming war. It was miserable stuff and had to be observed from close up. And one of the only times I was able to use it in that way was through going over with the infantry straight away, so that I saw that the stuff was bursting high up in the air. Well, all this stuff was very new to gunnery, all these corrections. And to jump the gun a bit, when we got into action first in the loose salient, Senior Subaltern said, I'm going to the Major, he's along in his dugout, to ask him if I can put on the meteor corrections on the guns. And when he got there, the Major, who was a regular, mark you, an Irishman, he said, my boy, this is war. This is practical stuff. Forget all that nonsense they taught you at the shop. If it's cold, cock her up a bit. And I'll come straight away to, I'll go back again afterwards, but I must come to the same thing that happened. The battery I was with, entrained at Farnborough siding, so I have horses and guns and everything else. The morning after the Battle of Jutland, and we'd all got the horrible news that a lot of our battle cruisers had been sunk, although we claimed a sort of moral victory because the Germans went back. Now, why were those sunk so easily by the Germans? Because we didn't do the same to them. I was in the cruiser Frobisher going up to Shanghai in 19... Oh, I can't remember the date.
Doesn't matter the date.
And when I was out with the Shanghai Defence Force, and I was talking to the gunnery officer, and I said, what happened? What was wrong at Jutland with this? And he said, well, the trouble was, you see, we had the, what they called the director system, which absolutely got them straight onto the target, which they would hit if the target stood still. But the target had got a certain distance. So what we did in Britain was we worked that out by rule of thumb. Whereas the Germans were more scientific. I said, well, how do we stand now? And he said, well, we're better than anybody else. We've got far the best system. That was so. We sank half the Italian fleet without being able to see it at all. And so...
How long were you at Shoebury Ness then, doing your training?
How often were?
How long were you at Shoebury Ness doing your...
Only 3 weeks. That was all.
And then from... That was the thing. And then you were sent to a training brigade at Brighton.
Yes.
That would
I
be
was
a,
just coming to that.
What, which... What... Do you know the number of the unit?
No, it was the... No, I can't remember the number. It was at the barracks there, we were there, and some people were put to watch the NCOs training the gunners at gun drill. I, fortunately, was assistant to an old boy. We went up on the downs each day training the drivers, cantering all over the place, giving the orders, you know. And then we'd get Dix's stew sent up there while we rested. We went on in the afternoon. We got back in terrific form to the barracks and then went off down Brighton to see what was going on there, you see. But it was a marvellously exciting business, training men like that up on the downs and galloping about the place. And I loved it.
You took to command then.
What?
You took to the art of command. You seem to have got on with men right from the start under your command.
I love men. Not as much as I love the ladies, but... But that's why I've got such a tremendous show of old comrades now. And they've planted a tree on my 90th birthday. You know? They're marvellous. But
what would you do in the evening? You say you went out to see that. What entertainment did you find in Brighton?
Went to bed. I had a friend, I forget it, called Morton, another young gunner. And we used to go off down there. And I'd never been to shows in my life except once a year to the Drury Lane pantomime. And so then, you see, you began to get it, Tonight's the Night, and Leslie Henson came down, and George Robey, and all the rest of them. Wonderful, it opened my eyes, you know. And when I left the shop, I went with another fella to London. We hadn't got any money, because you got 7 or 6 a day, you know. That just about paid your mess bill. But we went to London, we went to a show called Push and Go. And it was a marvellous show. They had Chinatown, My Chinatown in it, you know it? Oh, you haven't lived, you know. And then we stayed at the Regent Palace Hotel. 7 and 6 a night, and breakfast, good breakfast next morning, all for 7 and 6, but we could just about do it, that was all. And so that Brighton, it was very nice indeed. We couldn't really afford to do anything at all. And while I was there, after not too long, I was posted with some other young regulars to a division which had been held at home, the 40th, which was going to be a second Bantam division, you know what that means. And then they decided halfway through that it was better to make it half Bantam, half the battalions of Bantam. It's very good indeed, but I don't know what had gone wrong, but when they were tested on Salisbury Plain for their gunnery, there was a General Branker who always used to do it, and he used to get these fellows at the end paraded and said, "Your horses are dirty, your harness is dirty, your men are dirty, cannot shoot." And they'd be put back for another period, so they were still there. So they shoved us in. We were supposed to leaven the lump, you know. Just the same as when, before the Second World War, they moved Woolwich, combined it with Santa's, which annoyed all the gunners, because we thought we were a superior race. And when we complained, they said, "Oh, we're moving you to Sandhurst to leaven the lump," because we had much stiffer exams and training than they did, you know. So there you are. Well, we said goodbye to Brighton and were posted to the 40th Division, where the horses, a lot of them got ringworm, and I thought, well, this is awful, sure.
And what battery did you go to?
Huh?
Do you remember which battery you went to? Or which brigade?
Oh, I think it was 174th Brigade. I'm not sure. I tell you, that doesn't affect it very much. So after a couple of days, in the early morning, we took the horses and guns and all the paraphernalia down to the sidings at Farnborough, packed it up, and while we were doing that, we heard about Jutland. Derry, off we go. And we arrive at Southampton. And after I lunched with an uncle who was doing a job there, we embarked. We had a horrible trip across to Le Havre.
You mean it was rough weather?
Yeah, and the horses were being ill. It wasn't us so much. So when we'd shaken down at Le Havre, we went up to a little town behind the lights called Saint-Venant, and began to get the sort of spirit and so on, the place, because the French loved us to be billeted on them, because they were paid billeting money, you see. And they used to say that their own chaps, if they were billeted on them, complained a hell of a lot. We were much nicer. It was good fun. I was given a wonderful chap as a batman. We called him Officer Servants in those days.
What was his name? Do you remember?
Parmenter. He was a wonderful chap. He'd been second gardener to King Edward VII's friend, Duchess of, in the Eastern Counties, Terray. And he'd been made responsible for the cooking and feeding of the outside staff. He was a wonderful cook. The things he could do to a tin of bully beef were marvellous. And you know, bully beef, I don't know why they called it that, it's wonderful stuff. If you buy it now, it's damn expensive. You know it. I expect you eat it quite a lot. And then they had this wonderful, when you couldn't get the ordinary meat in rations sent up, you had this wonderful other iron ration, bully beef, and which is corned beef. And McConaughey's iron ration, which was a marvellous thing. So we all loved it. I'd much sooner have lived on the iron rations than on the other stuff. Generally, those were happy days.
What else would he do for you? He'd prepare your food when you weren't met, when there wasn't any, a mess. What else would he do for you, your servant?
Clean my buttons. And, but this doesn't happen nowadays. Nobody gets any help like that, majors or anybody else. And we were very right too. It was very lowering, I think. But the men didn't worry because they liked you because you liked them. And the nearer the front line you got, the nicer everybody was. It was a wonderful air up there. So we left our billets and went up into the Loos salient. The Loos, Battle of Loos, had been in September 1915. And we had, as usual, made an awful mess of things owing to the higher command. And were left with a wide salient where the Germans had the observation. And we had 60,000 killed for nothing, really. Now, after the first successes, and this is what generally happened in those early battles, we did very well. And then in order to develop it, you wanted fresh troops coming up. What had we got? Nothing except the usual cavalry corps, who poor dears, when they did come up, had a look-see, and the machine gun had taken command. They wouldn't realize this, that the horse wasn't everything. Even later, when there was a damn good book written where the people were specially trained for the first parts of an offensive, it was called The Cavalry Went Through. The cavalry never went through. You can't against machine guns.
Did you appreciate this right at the beginning of your military career?
Yes.
So you saw it straight away?
Yes, but you see, you couldn't say anything. The old men were there, and when in that most shocking thing, the Somme battle, they were made to go in with the most extraordinary arrangements, you know, going slowly, carrying all the pack on their back. When you complained, they even put in the highest orders that if people didn't do what they were told, that very heavy steps would be taken. You were far too frightened. Your career depended on it. And until you got one man who got half mad with his boys all being killed, and that was Siegfried Sassoon, he walked down the line and said, I'm not having any more. They said, the chap's mad. He was a VC type. He didn't get a VC, but he was that type. And...
Did you meet him at all?
Siegfried? I met him afterwards. I met him years afterwards. He was a most interesting character, because when I used to go down to the fellow who ran our canteens, this is in the police, to a lovely double village down in Wiltshire, and we used to walk and drink a lot of beer and have a wonderful time. And at night, the wife of the watch, we used to get on the squeezer, and Siegfried soon used to come in with his latest woman, and they'd dance on the table, and he was quite crackers. Then he turned very religious, finally, you know. But he was a great fellow. And you know his poetry, do you? Wonderful stuff. I've got a lot of it in a thing called Men That March Away, and that was by a lot of these fellows who were more modern, when he got over the heroics of poetry, and very bitter stuff.
Were you aware of the war poetry then, at the time, in the war? I mean, obviously.
No, not actually then, when we first arrived out there. Oh, I was, like everybody else, wildly enthusiastic. And as I was saying before, you knew you were going to get killed. And it was part of the fact, if you hadn't, and that comes into my life later in that, when I was invalided home for a few months, I felt I'd let the party down, my chaps. And I couldn't get back for a time. I had to fiddle my way out.
We'll come to that, yes. So, you were at St. Venant. Where did you go up into the line? Where was your battery position when you went up into the line?
Well, it was in the Loos Salient, near a little place called Vermel Village, and another one nearby called Philosophe, where the French were still living in the place, like they were down at Les Brebis, and Bully-Grenay, a double village, which was our rest place. This was when I was trench mortars, and the batteries were still all around there. Why they weren't shelled more by the Germans was that the Germans were saving their ammunition, and also they'd put a lot of money into the mines around there and the villages. It was German money, so that's why it wasn't too badly shelled.
What did a battery position look like at this time? You were on 18 pounders, weren't you?
Actually 4 or 5 hours.
You were on the howitzers, were you? What would a position look like? How was it organised?
Well, one, of course, it was hidden as far as possible by camouflage.
What sort of camouflage were they using at that stage of the war? This is just before the Somme, isn't it? What level of sophistication have they got to?
Well, it was wire or so on, wire covering, and was coloured stuff all in among it in order to make it look like the ground, that was all. There were times when you didn't worry. I can tell you why we won the war.
We'll come to that. I've seen it in your memoirs, yeah. So... how was it actually set out? What was the disposition? Where were the guns? Where did they put the radio hut, the signalers rather? And where would the officers and the men be?
Well, you had dugouts, you see. And the men had dugouts, sometimes quite near the guns. And there was a time when I took part in making our own dugouts.